This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Down by the river, where sweet waters flow, came a tumbling sound, logs and houses floating down. Nowhere to run. Down by the river, my heart stood still. Brown wall of terror, calling for higher ground, calling for salvation. They were swept away.
Welcome to Disaster World. We broke it. Now we must pay. When flash floods or record-breaking heat assault and astound us, scientists used to say individual events cannot be attributed to climate change, only trends. That is over. Our pollution of the atmosphere is creating disasters outside human experience. In Western Europe, new deadly heat is killing thousands of people. You all heard about deadly flash floods in Texas, New Mexico, and North Carolina in a single week. Already scientists lay out the facts. Extreme disasters have increased many times over since 1990. This is climate change. Let's start with Europe. Unless you live in France, Spain, Germany, or the UK, you don't know. Heat from the end of June to early July was brutal. They even closed the Acropolis for a few hours. A massive heat dome sat over the continent. Sea surface temperatures in the western Mediterranean surged up to 6 degrees C, above normal for this time of year. That ocean heat wave alone is bizarre and frightening. It seems impossible. We don't know what it means or what the impacts might be on sea life or our weather. Researchers from the Grantham Institute found, quote, human-caused climate change intensified the recent European heat wave and increased the number of heat deaths by about 1,500 people in 12 European cities. Focusing on 10 days of heat from June 23rd to July 2nd, the researchers estimated the death toll using peer-reviewed methods and found climate change nearly tripled the number of heat-related deaths, with fossil fuel use having increased heatwave temperatures up to 4 degrees C across the cities. They warn that heatwave temperatures will keep rising, and future death tolls are likely to be higher until the world largely stops burning oil, gas, and coal and reaches net zero emissions. It is the first rapid study to estimate the number of deaths linked to climate change for a heat wave and was led by scientists at Imperial College London and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. That's an end quote from a press summary by Imperial College London. Let me just add that these are no fringe scientists looking for a career bump. Grantham Institute and the co-authors are among the top in their field. They tend to be conservative and scientifically cautious. The study is titled Climate Change Tripled Heat-Related Deaths in Early Summer European Heat Wave in July 2025. Find a link in my blog. Let's hear a couple of minutes from two study authors, Garifalos Konstantinoudis and then Frederica Otto.
In late June and early this month, a heat wave brought extreme temperatures to Europe. Our study, published today, estimates that climate change tripled the expected death toll. It focused on 10 days of heat experienced by 12 cities from June 23 to July 2nd. Our study estimates that there would have been about 2,300 heat-related deaths across the cities, with 1,500 of them caused by the climate change-driven heat. This means that climate change is behind 65% of the excess deaths. Our results reflect how heat deaths can increase rapidly when temperatures reach certain thresholds that push vulnerable populations to their limits, particularly older people with underlying health conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and respiratory problems. An increasing heatwave temperature of just 2 to 4 degrees can mean the difference between life and death for thousands of people. Heatwaves don't leave a trail of destruction like wildfires or storms. This is why heatwaves are known as silent killers. Most heat-related deaths occur in homes and hospitals, out of public view, and are rarely reported. Our study is only a snapshot of the true death toll linked to climate change-driven temperatures across Europe, which might have reached into the tens of thousands.
This analysis is a hugely important development for the field. Since the early 2000s, dozens of attribution studies have shown how heat waves are getting hotter with climate change, typically by about 2 or 3 degrees. This study shows why these changes are so dangerous. Only a handful of studies have estimated heat-related death caused by climate change. Ours is the first ever to do it rapidly in near real time. The only way to avoid more intense heat waves is to stop burning oil, gas, and coal. Shifting from fossil fuels to renewable energy will lower emissions that heat the climate and intensify heat waves. We also need to make our cities resilient to high temperatures. Long-term strategies such as expanding green and blue spaces are needed. Short-term measures like cooling centers and formal support systems for vulnerable populations will also help save lives now.
That was the well-known climate scientist Frederica Otto speaking about their new study clearly showing extreme heat is increasing and killing thousands of Europeans. This is not a small thing. According to the UN World Health Organization, or WHO, their regional director, Dr. Hans Kluge, said, a staggering 175,000 people die from heat-related causes every year in Europe. Let me read that again. 175,000 people die from heat-related causes every year in Europe. And that figure is set to soar in line with our steadily warming planet. End quote. That is more than 8 times the number of people killed in road traffic accidents across the EU. Is this a problem? Obviously, more Europeans will want to save their lives and their loved ones from the new extreme heat. Many simple steps in society and government can help. After catastrophic loss of life in the 2003 heat wave, France took steps that somewhat reduced loss of life. And this may include things like checking on neighbors and shut-ins, cooling centers for the homeless and poor, public education about what to do and when heat is getting to you, planting street trees, and all of that. But now, as we leave climate action far too late, it's not enough. Northern European buildings were constructed to retain heat in winter and not to dissipate it in summer. There need to be long, expensive programs of insulating old homes and public buildings to reach net zero standards for survival. And that is not enough, and it doesn't come soon enough. Hundreds of millions of Europeans will install air conditioners or heat pumps in the coming years. The AC debate is raging in Europe these days. Millions of air conditioners blast even hotter air into the streets. They are noisy. They create a new summer electricity demand that may increase old energy plants, which make global warming worse. Can Europe race to power life-saving cooling with green energy? Or will they accept hundreds of thousands dying each year, counting it like a new plague? Assuming the poor are left to the last, could a heat wave lead to revolution or civil war? The unknowns multiply with each tenth of a degree of warming. Stranger still, if technology provides a fix for survival at 4 degrees C hotter in European cities, and fewer people die, the immediate problem of climate change might feel like it's solved. Getting off fossil fuels seems less likely and will be proclaimed dangerous. Well, that's like a new report from the formerly staid U.S. Department of Energy. They're pushing to keep coal plants operating, a new fossil power just going and going to cope with rising electricity demand. the DOE has been visibly taken over by the fossil fuel lobby in the U.S. Don't be fooled. Some American government institutions, even former scientific ones, are being reissued as propaganda tools. Sad.
This ain't normal. This ain't right. This ain't a mystery, Jack. You burn the sky, it floods you back. Burn the sky, it floods you back.
UK scientists rapidly determined recent European heat was made worse and more likely by excess greenhouse gases. But what about the flash floods that captivated the American news networks? In the first week of July 2025, there were, as you know, flash floods in Kerrville, Texas, Reduso, New Mexico, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Chicago. In Chapel Hill, well inland from the Atlantic coast, responders rescued people from shopping malls and roads. The Haw River reached a new record, up 32.5 feet, while the Eno River went up 25 feet. As in New Mexico and Texas, the speed of river cresting was astonishing in North Carolina. A wall of water and debris came downstream before the warnings were out. No one was killed this time. The Chapel Hill floods were attributed to remnants of Tropical Storm Chantel. In the remote mountain town of Reduso, New Mexico, there was a double climate connection. They got a super rain flash flood event. We will get to that. But according to the Washington Post, quote, the flooding was triggered by approximately 3.5 inches of rain falling on a burn scar in about a 90-minute period, pushing water directly into the community, the mayor said. The burn scar was the result of wildfires that ravaged thousands of acres in that area last year, including the South Fork Fire. Yes, 2023, actually, was a year of extreme wildfires burning through New Mexico during one of its longest heat waves ever. But the River Reduso area was burned by the South Fork and Salt fires in 2024. Hundreds of homes were lost. Radio EcoShock has covered the extensive links between climate change and extreme wildfires in at least a dozen shows. I'll give you links to those interviews with scientists in my show blog at ecoshock.org. So Reduso suffered a compound climate event, as we have talked about on this show, wildfire scars followed by flash floods. That is how climate change works.
Radio EcoShock.
In June 2022, Jonathan Gourley from the NOAA National Severe Storms Lab co-authored a paper about U.S. floods. The open access paper is called Spatiotemporal Characteristics of U.S. Floods, Current Status and Forecast Under a Future Warmer Climate. They found overall flood frequency increases 100%, covering 44% more area with, quote, more random and unpredictable events throughout the year, end quote. That sounds as serious as sea level rise and heat waves to me. I'm going to replay that interview for you shortly. But let's get to the hundreds dead along the Guadalupe River on the 4th of July. What an awful mess this is in Texas. As in Chapel Hill and New Mexico, stunning videos show a river that became a land tsunami in minutes during the night. 10 inches of rain fell in the Kerrville region. The quiet Guadalupe River rose 29 feet in 45 minutes. Think about that. The Houston Chronicle, July 9th, ran this story by Rebecca Ward. Climate change worsened rainfall that triggered Camp Mystic floods like steroids for the weather. Texas climate scientists like Andrew Dessler pointed immediately to climate change. That is courage in the current anti-climate, anti-science environment in America these days. He will get a chorus of criticism and boos and possibly death threats. Three European scientists just released a fast report about it too. Their title is Heavy Rain in July 2025 Texas Floods, Locally Intensified by Human-Driven Climate Change. Lead author is David Faranda from the French National Center for Scientific Research. Co-authors are from Oxford and INGV in Italy. There was no heat wave in Central Texas on July 4th. Temperatures were a bit below average. While this scientific team finds natural climate variability is a factor in those flash floods, the speed and magnitude of this event could not have happened without a warmer atmosphere. In scientific language, quote, "Natural variability alone cannot explain the changes in precipitation associated with this very exceptional meteorological condition," end quote. Yes, it was climate change, no matter what the governor or the president says. Mind-bending flash floods are appearing in many parts of the world in the last 3 years especially. They washed through old European cities and recently hit parts of Russia. China experienced epic flash floods this year and last. Australia had unbelievable downpours in hours. Their rivers swelled up and overflowed the banks. This is a global threat. A paper published in March 2021, led by Nicholas Christidis, said this about the United Kingdom's prospects. Compared to a hypothetical natural climate, we estimate a tenfold increase in the chances of such extreme rainfall events in the United Kingdom by the end of this century, which underlines the need for effective adaptation planning, end quote. I'm going to draw on reporting from environmental journalist Stephen Leahy in his Need to Know Substack. Quote, "Record high 24-hour rainfall extremes occurred 52% more often in 2024 than during the 1995-2005 period, according to the 2024 Global Water Monitoring Report." 52% more often in 2024 alone. Recall last year's devastating flash floods in Valencia, Spain? Stephen Leahy asks. He says, over 770 millimeters, 30 inches of rain in just a few hours. It was Spain's worst weather disaster, claiming 232 lives and totaling 18 billion euros in damages, with 11,242 homes destroyed and 120,000 vehicles written off. It also turns out that hotter ground temperatures lead to stronger updrafts of water-laden air masses. These then cool down faster, resulting in heavier rainfall, according to a new study in the journal Nature. This has led to a 15% increase in torrential rainfall events lasting only a few hours, as well as an increase in flash flooding. The temperature increase caused by climate change leads to more intense precipitation locally, the study concluded. Thank you, Stephen Leahy at Substack, for digging into all of this for us. Find a link to that 2024 Global Water Monitoring Report in my weekly blog at ecoshock.org. Folks, we all need to learn about this new flash flood phenomenon. We need to be prepared. Stephen points to new science published in the journal Nature in March 2025. The title is "Increasing Hourly Heavy Rainfall in Austria, Reflected in Flood Changes." This is the smoking gun, but as always with Earth systems, there is a twist. The Austrian weather stations reported a 15% increase in hourly heavy rainfall over the last four decades. Most of this is from higher water-holding capacity in a warmer atmosphere. But the daily figures for heavy rainfall, the longer-lasting variety, depend more on atmospheric changes due to warming. The results warn small rivers may be more dangerous than large ones. Here's a quote from the abstract of that 2025 paper. They find a bigger role of atmospheric circulation modes than previously thought. The daily heavy rainfall changes are remarkably consistent with observed flood increases of about 8% in large catchments. The hourly heavy rainfall changes are similarly consistent with flood changes in small catchments, although the flood increase is stronger, 25% over the last four decades. Climate adaptation measures in flood management may therefore be more pressing for rivers draining smaller catchment areas than for large rivers, end quote. I hope emergency planners are listening, as well as listeners who think that they are safe beside small rivers or streams. Maybe don't put your house or tent or RV down by the river in this brave new climate. Again, bolstering weather services, better emergency warnings like sirens and rules about buildings and camping can save lots of lives. I hope we do. We tend, though, to only pay attention to deaths, so a reduction may hide the growing problem for a while, until it gets worse. Also strange, some developed countries, especially those that dismantle science and public policy, or consider themselves masters of the universe, are lagging behind poorer countries in adapting. Following mass deaths during tsunamis and tropical typhoons, both India and Bangladesh greatly improved public policy to protect lives. For example, Bangladesh built shelters along the coast that resist extreme winds and high water. The Indian Army has evacuated 1 million people with countless trucks before a typhoon could hit. Why are Europeans and Americans so blindsided by the new heat waves and flash floods? There must be psychological, social, and cultural barriers to recognize this face of climate change. Those of us who pollute the most, maybe we excuse ourselves from the scene until the dragon comes. Let's get to my 2021 interview with Jesse Norris from UCLA. Dr. Norris specializes in these small-scale but large-impact weather events.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
On Saturday, 21st of August, an impossible 17 inches of rain, 43 centimeters, fell on Waverly, Tennessee, a little town west of Nashville. More than 20 people were killed in a surprise rush of water. In Europe, mid-July, record-busting rains brought floods, killing at least 165 people in Germany and 31 in Belgium. Extreme precipitation events are popping up all over the world. Could it happen where you are? And is it climate change? At the University of California, Los Angeles, Dr. Jesse Norris specializes in these small-scale but large-impact weather events. Educated in the UK at the University of Manchester, Norris is a postdoctoral researcher at UCLA and co-author of a timely new scientific piece answering many of our questions. From Southern California, Jesse Norris, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good morning. Nice to be on.
Why are these strange torrents of water popping up all over the world, surprising even scientists?
So in the study that we've recently published, we've looked at the intensification of precipitation extremes around the world. And so if you imagine the most intense precipitation events that occur in any location, our study is finding that on a global scale, so when you can consider the whole globe collectively, they are intensifying. So they have been intensifying in recent decades, which we have attributed to anthropogenic climate change, that means man-made climate change, and are projected to continue doing so. And so our study does not really go into this, but on an essential level, it's because as the climate warms, it can hold more water vapor. And so when the really extreme storms happen, they have more water vapor available to precipitate out. And so we're typically seeing when those most extreme events happen, they have more available moisture to precipitate. On a basic level, that's leading to the intensification. There are various other physics involved that can change that relationship.
Right, and it's not just happening in places reported by the Western press. I've seen these events pop up in Chad and in South America, in Australia. It's really kind of a strange phenomenon. Now, you specialize in something called mesoscale meteorology. What is that, and how does it compare with the big weather maps we see on TV?
So mesoscale is a scale of weather that's typically on the scale of tens to hundreds of kilometers. So it's essentially the study of how precipitation systems affect how regional precipitation can be affected by processes that are occurring on a relatively small scale. So this is in contrast to what we call the synoptic scale, which is the scale of oceans and continents where large-scale weather systems evolve. But then when we look at the mesoscale, there are much more complicated processes which are involved, which can intensify precipitation locally, depending on what's happening in that specific region.
A few scientists on this show, and certainly the IPCC reports, tagged extreme precipitation events as a developing threat in a warming world. But the big models did not pick up such high intensity of localized events like those seen this year. What are the problems between those big models and the kind of work we need?
So there are a lot of processes occurring, as I explained, on the mesoscale and even going smaller on what we call the convective scale. So the mesoscale is looking at processes on a scale of tens to hundreds of kilometers. But then what we call the convective scale, which is just on the scale of 1 kilometer or less, there are processes which are very complex and involve very complex physics, which as much as models are advancing, there are always going to be processes that are occurring unexpectedly in the atmosphere, which can lead to intensification on very short timescales that might not have been seen by models. So all the time, improvements are being made to make the forecasting models to give them more accurate precipitation forecasts, but there are still very complex processes occurring on very small scales where a large-scale storm can interact with the local geography to locally intensify precipitation and lead to precipitation amounts in very small areas which are extremely intense and have been leading to the devastation that you described.
Is extreme rainfall or snowfall, when the air is cold enough, are they limited to certain locales known for rain, or can they happen almost anywhere in the world?
Yes, so there are certain regions which are certainly more prone to extreme precipitation events. So that's the combination of rainfall and snowfall. Generally, we look to the tropics to be the most at-risk areas, which is where there's the most warmth in the atmosphere. By association, can lead to the greatest rainfall or snowfall amounts. But also in other parts of the world, when the conditions are just right. So we've seen, as you described, in Western Europe, which is in what we call the mid-latitudes, and also here in Southern California, in the subtropics, whichever type of region it is, we can still see, although average precipitation might not increase, we can still see individual events that can really wreak havoc. And depending on the processes that cause precipitation in the local region, those, when the conditions are just right, due to greater warmth in the atmosphere associated with climate change, those can become all the more intense as the climate warms.
Where I live in Western Canada, we just went through a 7-week heat wave, including the hottest temperatures ever recorded in this country, and the U.S. West was even hotter. And looking at the surrounding hills outside my home, I could see a haze of the last of the water being sucked out of the ground, heading into the sky. Does water from the drought-stricken West add extra juice to rainfall in other places?
That's a pretty complicated question. I suppose it can. So when water vapor is evaporated from the surface somewhere, it can be transported somewhere else. And when there's all the more water vapor in the atmosphere, that can lead to all the more intense precipitation in whichever region experiences the storms. So yes, in theory, as a general perspective, the more water vapor in the atmosphere, which can be stored in the atmosphere or in the land surface, wherever that water vapor ends up when it precipitates out, that can cause all the more intense storms, all the more intense rainfall amounts.
But I guess most of the water up there actually comes from evaporation off the oceans. Is that correct?
That's right, yes. But again, with warmer surfaces, that evaporation is going to be all the greater, and then because the atmosphere is warmer, it's capable of storing all the more water vapor. So whether it's in the ocean surface or the land surface, the warmer temperatures are going to lead to greater evaporation, and so greater amounts of precipitation.
Within weeks of the deadly July 13th floods in Northern Europe, a group of scientists called World Weather Attribution released a report finding intense summer rains in Western Europe are more likely and will happen more often in the coming years due to climate change. How can they know that?
So I'm not familiar with the specifics of that study, but I'm assuming that they have studied climate models that have projected for that particular region, that as they go through time, although they can't attribute any individual event to climate change, they can see that the models very clearly project an increasing probability of events of that magnitude to occur as the climate warms and we move through the 21st century.
Well, listeners, I'll put a link to that report in my show blog at ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. Alex with Jesse Norris, UCLA.
If the skies can just open up and pour like we have never seen, and that's well beyond our drains and our local waterways to handle, and probably beyond our insurance company's ability to handle, this makes a warming world sound like an even more unstable place to be, in addition to the heating, which we've all talked about. Is that what you think is developing?
What do you mean by more unstable?
Well, you know, the concert in Central Park on August 21st, We Love New York City homecoming concert, was suddenly rained down, more rain in 2 hours than ever recorded in Central Park, and they have records going back a long way. It just seems like you can't count on much if you have rains that are beyond what we've seen before.
That's right, yeah. Also, although the projection in a lot of regions is that there will be more dry periods, when those big rain events do come, they're going to be all the more intense. So, for example, here in Southern California, we go months and months without precipitation, but then we'll just have a huge deluge just in the space of a couple of weeks. So that's a particularly extreme case, but it seems that the projections around the world are for that to be, as you state, more unstable, so that you can expect it. Both extreme dry periods, but also more extreme rain when it does come.
Rain and weather's always been uneven and difficult to predict, especially for smaller regions. As your paper explains, there are so many variable factors, from short-term forces to very long cycles. But before the new methods used by your team, it seems scientists were unable to clearly prove that extreme precipitation events during the last century have increased. Is that the case?
So it's not completely accurate that other studies haven't been able to show intensification of precipitation. So generally, the previous studies have been restricted to specific regions. And so previous studies have shown that in specific regions that precipitation has been intensifying in recent decades. But because of the natural variability in the climate system, you can always get some regions where you might see an intensification, and then some regions where you might see a weakening. So the goal of this study was to bring all of the regions on Earth together and say collectively, are the regions where precipitation has been intensifying, are there enough of those to say that on a global scale that this is happening, and it's more than what we would just expect from noise? To do that, we used the novel machine learning method.
I got to ask you about that. Artificial neural networks, or ANN, dare we mere mortals ask, what is that? What is machine learning, and how did you use it?
So I was not the lead author on this study, so I was not intricately involved with the technical details here, but just on a conceptual level, it's where in this case, we feed in global maps of extreme precipitation. So we feed in global maps each year, and so we see the evolution of the global distribution of extreme precipitation over time, and then in terms of that spatial structure from a global perspective, the machine is able to interpret those maps and say, okay, the ones that you're feeding us from more recently, I can tell the difference between those and the ones that you're feeding me from, say, the early 20th century. That it can tell that the maps in more recent times are profoundly different because precipitation is intensifying in sufficiently many regions that it's beyond what could be expected from noise.
I think that's amazing science, and I don't know how far artificial intelligence can take us, but nature's so complex, it looks like we're going to need something beyond our personal minds to crack it.
Yes, we're becoming extremely reliant on increasing computer power to solve the very complex mathematical and physical problems that are necessary to make reliable climate projections. And so, yes, machine learning is becoming an increasingly useful tool for various applications of climate science, and it's able to process an amount of data which we are not able to do so at all, and make inferences about what is happening to the climate system as we progress through the 21st century. And so this is one particular application, but there are all sorts of other applications that are being used to be able to make inferences about what climate change is doing to, whether it's precipitation or temperature or winds or evaporation or whatever you like, which we would not be able to do without these sophisticated artificial intelligence.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Jesse Norris, postdoctoral atmospheric researcher at UCLA. We're talking about new science that can tell us more about deadly extreme rainfall events in many parts of the world. Well, I'm getting in over my head here, but we might as well take a shot at it. I read that your team found positive relevance for some parts of the world, including the East Asian monsoon and both North Pacific and North Atlantic storm tracks, but negative relevance for other parts of the world. What does that mean, and why is it important?
Okay, so as I alluded earlier, when we're looking at the global patterns of these precipitation events, and so the challenge is that there are, in fact, some regions where, a small number of regions, where precipitation has becoming weaker. So what we're trying to do is consider all of those regions together and say that collectively the globe is experiencing more extreme rainfall. And so in this context, where we refer to positive relevance, these are the regions such as the East Asian monsoon, as you mentioned, which is where the greater signal is being received. And then negative relevance are typically in the arid regions of the world, the Earth's deserts, where you're in fact seeing rainfall becoming less intense over time. And so the job of the neural network that's trying to solve this problem with artificial intelligence is to sort these regions with what we call positive relevance and negative relevance, and establish that the regions with positive relevance are in fact greater than those with negative relevance.
Well, you've just stimulated an interesting idea in me. We talk about extreme rainfall events, but maybe there are weakened rainfall events. I mean, sometimes here now, instead of a rain, we just see big splattery drops that are about a foot apart. You can almost walk in between the raindrops. Maybe there is a new kind of rain developing in the drier areas. What do you think?
Are you referring to in Canada there?
Well, in the desert areas of the West, let's say.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we're generally expecting a decrease in, so what we refer to as drizzle, we generally expect a decrease of that, and so we expect longer dry spells with completely blue skies and no precipitation. But when the really extreme storms happen, that they are all the more intense. So that is something that is in fact projected to decrease in a warming climate. I suppose that can be almost considered as zero precipitation, the kind of events that you're referring to. But that the occurrence of something like that is not something that generally we would expect an increase of.
And this new paper, led by Gavin D. Matakumbura and the UCLA team, was published in the journal Nature on July 6, 2021, just a week before the freak floods in Northern Europe. That was pretty good timing, don't you think?
Yes, it was indeed. Yes, there, as well as there were extreme monsoon rains in India and in China with all sorts of devastating impacts. So, yeah, we would argue that whenever we publish such a study, there are going to be examples around the world, whether it's in those regions that happens to experience those extreme events at that time, or if the study had been published at another time than perhaps California or Australia or wherever else we might have seen. Although it's not something that is nice to hear about, that generally there are, whenever you might want to talk about this, there are examples right outside your door that you can look to.
No shortage of news stories about it, and I know that I'm going to be reporting on this for as long as we keep the show going. There's just going to be more shocking rainfall events. But the paper does note that the helpful results from machine learning do not include the possibility of rare events like a big volcanic eruption, and they may not account properly for long-term variability like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. So if one of these years several volcanoes blow, could that throw off predictions about extreme rain and extreme drought?
Yes. Yeah, so in the past, when we've seen major volcanic eruptions, that can actually result in a temporary global cooling. And so that has the tendency to have the opposite effect of what we're seeing in the longer term. So that can interrupt the long-term trend that we're seeing. But generally, these kind of events, even when they're volcanic eruptions of such intensity as, for example, Pinatubo in 1992, I believe, which caused global cooling for a few years and interrupted, led to what is often referred to as the global warming hiatus. These cooling events are always just very short-lived and ultimately are not changing the long-term trend that we have been seeing in recent decades and can expect to continue seeing.
Well, we know from the records that there was a super drought lasting hundreds of years in the American Southwest many hundreds of years ago, and that was not human-induced climate change. And likewise, Australia may have entered a long, wetter rain cycle just as the first European settlers arrived around the 1700s. How can we separate human-induced changes to rainfall from those deep historic patterns?
Generally, we look at the time scales of the variability. So we, in the past, we've always seen variability on the scale of tens of years, for example. But when we look at the temperature record going back to pre-industrial times, we can see a very clear warming trend, which is on a scale that is greater than what has been observed in terms of natural temperature variability. It's a challenge of separating the signal from the noise, and in this case we have enough of a signal to, so events that you refer to we would consider as noise in the grand scheme of things, and so in the data generally we see sufficient signal to be able to say that those kind of events are just natural variability and that they are ultimately dwarfed by the longer term warming trend, which in this case is leading to a longer term trend of intensifying rainfall.
A study published in June 2021 on Geophysical Research Letters found on our current emissions path, extreme storms over Europe might be up to 14 times more common by the year 2100 than they were in the year 2000. And that sounds pretty serious, not only in terms of human lives lost, but it's really costly to keep rebuilding when floods become common. Do you think planners and the rest of us are underestimating the growing threat of extreme precipitation and floods?
Absolutely, and I suppose it's impossible to try to imagine the scale of damage that can be done around the world and the rebuilding that will be necessary to compensate. So moving forward, some serious efforts should be taken, I suppose, to make the infrastructure more resilient to these kind of events, so that there isn't just this huge rebuilding effort each time. But that's certainly easier said than done. So I suppose it's not really our area to comment on what the response in terms of infrastructure and planning should be. But yes, in general, we can expect an increasing challenge to rebuild and prepare ourselves for the kind of flooding that in all areas around the world should become more frequent in the future.
In another area of your research, I have to say some scientific findings are unsatisfying for the rest of us because the conclusions often include a wide range of uncertainty. In a made-up example, I could just make it up. We could say we might get 2 to 12 more inches of rain by the 2040s, for example, but that's anything from a little more water to outright repeated floods included in that range. So, Jesse, you specialize in something called emergent constraints. What is that, and how can that help us?
So this is where we look at a range of projections from different climate models. So we have many climate models available, which different modeling centers around the world produce. And then in general, the scientific community tries to put all of these models together because we know that there's a wide range in projections from different models. And so we try to put all of the models together so that collectively they can perhaps make some insightful projections. And so because of the large spread in projections from different models, this leads us to the notion of what we call emergent constraints, which is where we identify a relationship between the model spread in our projected metric, for example, how much precipitation will intensify in the future, and we relate this to the model spread in a metric which is measurable by observations. So those same models that make the projections are also used to model the current climate, which is, of course, observable because we have all sorts of weather stations measuring precipitation and everything else. And so we relate the model spread in the future projection to the model spread in the present climate metric. And then based on that comparison, that allows us to infer perhaps which of the climate models are the most realistic in their projection of the future metric that is ultimately of interest. And so this allows us, if we then have a large spread of model projections for our metric of interest, that ultimately allows us to reduce that spread because we can ultimately throw out the models which, based on this method, can be concluded to be unreliable.
Jesse Norris, you also just co-authored a paper in June 2021 called A Distinct Atmospheric Mode for California Precipitation. Radio Equishock is broadcast by over a dozen radio stations in California. What can listeners there, in a nutshell, hope to look for in this new science?
So this study was about identifying the variability over the Pacific Ocean that is relevant for California precipitation. Ultimately, the goal of the study that you refer to was to try and establish how well the climate models that we use to make projections of global climate, but also of regional climate, for example, Californian climate in the future. So the goal is to identify how well those climate models are representing the variability over the Pacific Ocean, which is ultimately relevant for predicting California's climate. And in that case, we found actually a reasonable agreement between the models and the observations, which is encouraging in terms of using those models to make predictions of, in this case, California climate in the 21st century.
As we wrap up here, Jesse, are there any other thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I would just reiterate that our study, as well as many others, showing that what has already been observed historically shows very clear evidence that the warming climate has been leading to intensified precipitation events. And so what this study is essentially doing is validating the models that we are using to make projections for the 21st century. And so given this validation of the models, this makes it important to listen to what those models are projecting for the 21st century, which is that precipitation events are going to be intensifying far beyond what we've already witnessed in recent decades. And so this is something that should be taken into account and prepared for from a societal level, because unfortunately we do expect these kind of events to intensify beyond what has been observed thus far.
As Bob Dylan said, a hard rain is going to fall. We have been speaking with Dr. Jesse Norris, postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of California, Los Angeles. Find links to his latest work and news articles about this summer's surprise floods in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jesse, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Nice talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio Ecoshock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
EcoShock 2006.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money.
a best of Radio EcoShock replay. For 31 years, Ross Gelbspan was an investigative reporter and editor for the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. His work led to a Pulitzer Prize. Retiring in 1998, he wrote the book, The Heat Is On, The Climate Crisis, The Cover-Up, The Prescription. President Clinton read it. His 2004 book is Boiling Point, reviewed in the New York Times by Al Gore. Gelbspan has appeared at the World Economic Forum and regularly in the largest American media. His latest speech was organized by Mark Breslow of the Mass Climate Action Network. The topic is Straddling Between Solutions and Survivalism. Getting published on global warming has been a challenge for even top-named reporters like Ross Gelbspan. He explains the huge gulf in media and public awareness between America and other parts of the world, particularly Europe. Other governments and publics have long recognized the dangers of climate change. This barrier to information in America has become a fixation for Gelbspan. He has taken a lead in exposing the corruption of the public mind, oiled by millions in propaganda dollars from the fossil fuel industry. He says the major media outlets are blinkered, seeing politics in everything, so they fail to cover issues outside the political sphere. Like science, for example, facts are not political.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money. This fusion of corporate interests and government power has proved an almost insurmountable obstacle to the climate movement's ability to get its larger message across. So I think a really critical focus for climate activists should be on the press. And I know from my own experience that when the press covers an issue thoroughly and consistently, the public responds, laws get passed. I think in this case it would mobilize the public in 6 months. Unfortunately, the industry public relations specialists have been so successful in promoting equivocal and confusing climate coverage that the American public is about 10 years behind the rest of the world in this area. There are a number of reasons for this, none of them really justifiable. Let me just go through one of scores of these reasons for why the press behaves the way it does. One reason, I think, is the fact that the career path at the top of news outlets normally follows lies in following the track of political reporting. Top editors tend to see all issues through a political lens. Early in his administration, and this is one example, President Bush declared he would not accept the findings of the IPCC because they represent foreign science, even though half the scientists who contribute to the IPCC are American scientists. Instead, Bush called on the U.S. National Academy of Sciences to provide American science. What I found astounding was this. Even as the Washington Press Corps reported the story, not one reporter that I saw bothered to check the position of the NAS. Had they done so, they would have found that as early as 1992, 3 years before the IPCC declared that we are changing the climate, the NAS was pushing for strong measures to minimize the impacts of human-induced global warming.
Some of Gelbspan's most famous reporting exposed the links between fossil fuel corporations and a handful of paid scientists who implanted the impression of a debate within science about the human role in climate change. But there was no debate in scientific journals or among thousands of experts in the field. Gelbspan compared this effort to cloud our thinking to the public relations efforts of the tobacco lobby, who found experts to deny that smoking caused cancer. History may find the Exxon and Peabody lobbyists help kill more people than the tobacco industry as climate change unfolds in floods, heat waves, droughts, and storms. Some have argued that the foundation of newspaper sales and television viewers is controversy and conflict. So the media simply fell into their old model to sell the fake climate controversy supplied by public relations companies and their paid hack experts. Gelbspan, who knows the media industry as well as anyone, doesn't let the press off so easily. He says irreparable damage has been done to the planet while valuable years were wasted in denial, led by the mainstream media. As he digs away at the black dollars that bought time for ever-growing and excessive profits for the fossil fuel industry, Ross finds the media as guilty as the carbon kings. Let's listen to a few clips from his recent speech, starting with the fake debate.
The next reason has to do with this campaign of disinformation launched by the coal industry and carried forward by ExxonMobil. As I mentioned, the fossil fuel lobby paid a tiny handful of scientists to dismiss the reality of climate change. That campaign has had a profoundly corrosive effect on journalists by insisting this issue of climate change be cast as a debate, when in fact there is no debate whatsoever in the community of mainstream scientists. When it's a story involving opinion, a journalist is ethically obligated to give the major competing points of view their best shot, their about equal space, and their most articulate presentation. But when it's a question of fact, it's up to a reporter to get off his or her butt and find out what the facts are. In this case, we know what the facts are.
Reporters and editors, Gelbspan says, have broken the public trust on the environment story. Isn't this media denial handy for all of us? Why should we make personal sacrifices or expect expensive action by government or big business if we aren't sure about it? The fossil fuel companies know full well that many of us wish the whole greenhouse gas problem would just float away into the sky along with our exhaust. As his speech develops, Gelbspan seems to say the public might be panicked if it knew the true extent of damage already done to the climate.
As one co-chair of the IPCC said to me, there is no debate among any statured scientists working on this issue about the larger trends of what is happening to the climate. That is something you would never know from American press coverage. But it is something you should point out to every editor and reporter you encounter as you work to get your message out. Stop approaching reporters like beggars asking for a handout. Let them know how angry you are at them for allowing themselves to be conned into betraying their public trust. One researcher who surveyed more than 300 peer-reviewed research articles a couple of years ago found that not one questioned the larger consensus about human-induced warming. By contrast, much of the coverage in the U.S. continues to cast this issue as a debate, and that's exactly what the public relations specialists of big coal and big oil want. They don't care who wins the debate, as long as the public perceives it to be a debate. And that way people can shrug their shoulders and walk away and say, come back and tell us what you know when you really know what you're talking about. To keep the issue framed as a debate allows the public to avoid confronting what can be a frightening and potentially emotionally overwhelming threat.
Gelbspan was asked to leave the audience with a note of optimism, but he changed his title to reflect the divided feelings many in the field hold. His new title, Straddling Between Solutions and Survivalism. I think we're going to need both, ways to survive a very bumpy transition to a carbonless, sustainable economy, even while we implement the solutions that will save future generations from hell on earth. We're going to get some of both, folks. There is a whole chorus of people, from net bloggers to senior scientists, who are thinking about survivalism if we can't adapt our political and economic systems soon enough. Things may fall apart.
Because of the success of this deeply dishonest campaign of information control, we find ourselves today in a sort of schizophrenic predicament. We are torn between the promise of solutions and the impulse towards survivalism. The situation is that dire.
Meanwhile, this seasoned journalist pleads for everyone to drop the political angle. Climate change doesn't care about conservatives, liberals, or even greens, for that matter. Greenhouse gases operate by the laws of physics, not by the grace of campaign donations. Here is a short list of conservatives who warned about climate change.
For example, many editors view climate change as a kind of proxy issue for political liberals. That's not the case. The earliest and very forceful advocate on this stuff was Margaret Thatcher, Britain's conservative prime minister. William F. Buckley has published serious warnings about global warming. Jim Woolsey, former CIA director, and Republican Senator Richard Lugar had a long piece in Foreign Affairs a couple of years ago about the need to deal with climate change. President Bush's first Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, has likened the coming impacts of climate change to a nuclear holocaust. And the one senator taking the lead to regulate carbon emissions is conservative Senator John McCain. It would be really useful if journalists were to spend a bit of time examining the real rather than the assumed politics of climate change.
I rate Ross Gelbspan up there with the great climate communicators like Al Gore, George Monbiot, Elizabeth Colbert, and Mark Linus. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. There's tons of free downloads there, too.